Who is a wise man?
I hope, brethren, that you've been noticing our theme text. It's been sitting before us this entire morning, and it's a beautiful text. If you have your Bibles, let's turn to that area. We'd like to look together at the Epistle of James, chapter 3, verses 13 to 18. And we're going to go through it, not so much verse by verse, as word by word. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Basically, we're going to spend almost the first two-thirds of our talk looking at the first part of this passage and trying to grasp exactly the concepts that James is presenting. And then we'll look at the theme text and see how this balances and gives a full range to the picture. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Wisdom and knowledge are related terms. Wisdom and knowledge are not identical terms. In fact, knowledge is not even really a good translation of the word imbued with knowledge in this case. But first, let's lay before our minds three related terms: wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Knowledge is the product of education. Understanding is the product of contemplation. Wisdom is the product of application. Knowledge deals strictly with the mind. Understanding connects the mind to the heart. And wisdom is where the heart takes over from the mind into the areas of action. The usual Greek word for knowledge is gnosis or epinosis, words relating to the concept of information and knowledge. However, the word translated here, endued with knowledge, is one word, and I can't pronounce it very well, but I'll say episteman. It's very seldom used. In fact, it's only used this one time in the New Testament and only one time in the Septuagint in the Old Testament. It has more to do with a knowledge that is gained by long familiarity with a person as opposed to a knowledge that you gain by meeting somebody. Oh, I know that person. But do you really know them, or do you just know that they exist? Have you gotten that personally acquainted? The thought here is that knowledge that comes more of a long identification with, and probably is better comprehended under the word understanding. Probably the thought is more, who is a wise man and endued with understanding among you? There is a similar expression in the Old Testament, and I think it gives a little depth to the meaning of what James is talking about. It's found in the first chapter of Deuteronomy. And Moses here is reviewing the fact that as he dealt with the Israelites, he needed to have help because there were more Israelites with problems than he could handle in a day's work. And so he was seeking out judges from among the people. And it's this seeking out of judges that he's addressing. And he says in Deuteronomy 1:13, take you wise men and understanding, known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And then he says again in verse 15, so I took the chief of your tribe, wise men and known, and made them heads over you. Here was the concept of individuals who not only knew the information for governing, but they had the comprehension of the other person to understand how and why rules applied. Turning to Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, we have a further linkage as to how this understanding and this wisdom is gained. Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 and 6. Moses again speaking, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land where you go. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Wisdom and understanding were the product of a thorough comprehension of the principles of God's law and of how they applied to specific situations. I don't know if any of you had the problem I did in looking at the program for this convention, but I looked at that front page and I puzzled and I puzzled. And I said, now the theme text is the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable. And their theme hymn is to the work, to the work. And I said, now how do these two relate one to the other? Deuteronomy 4 tells us how they relate one to the other. Choose you men of wisdom and understanding so that they may make known to the nations about you. Wisdom and understanding are outreaches. They are not only for the interior, but they are to reach out. They are for the public witness as well in their scope. Who is a wise man and endued with understanding? Rephrasing the question, how do you find a wise man and one who is endued with understanding? And the answer is, he will be shown out of a good conversation by the works that he produces with the meekness of wisdom. I believe we all recognize that the word conversation here is in the old English sense of the word. He will show by his behavior. If conversation meant in the scripture what conversation means today, then the verse would have to be translated, let him show out of a good conversation his words with meekness of wisdom. But let him show out of his behavior his works with meekness of wisdom. Wisdom here is identified by its meekness. Wisdom is not identified here by its humility. Humility may be a part of it, but meekness is the attribute that is here given to wisdom. Meekness, as opposed to humility, does not merely mean a position below others, but it means a position of an open ear willing to be instructed and informed. Meekness can be just as well translated teachableness. Show that you are such a person by having your behavior directed with the wisdom that is teachable. We always say that the bottom line is conscience. And conscience has the thought of knowledge. Conscience with knowledge. The word is made up of those two words that means having knowledge. But conscience is not always an absolutely correct guide. Consciences need educating. Have the meekness of wisdom, the conscience that is willing to be attuned and educated. He begins in verse 14 with a contrast. But if, instead of this meekness of wisdom, you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts. The word translated envy here is the word zelos, frequently translated zeal. It's a word that is as frequently used in a good sense as it is in a bad sense. It is used both ways. It is translated zealous. It's translated jealous. Same word. Same thought in the Greek. It merely means intense feeling. Intensity. And the word bitterness here is describing that intensity. But if you have a motivation, a zealousness that is based upon bitterness and strife, that's something that is wrong. This word that is translated bitter in this passage is found just a little bit earlier in the book. Can a pure fountain give forth good water and bitter water? Bitter has a thought of sour. So let me give you a very colloquial translation of this verse. If you are motivated by sour grapes or by strife, this will be a lie against the truth. That if the motivation in the use of this wisdom is a reaction to a negative experience you received, then this is against the concept of true wisdom. That is not teachable. That is already decided. My first objective is to prove myself right. And that's really what this word strife implies. This word strife is connected elsewhere with vainglory. Vainglory and strife. Philippians 2:3. If the motivation of my zeal is either reacting against a sour experience or to prove myself right, then he says, forget about it. Glory not. Don't boast. It's a lie. Lie not against the truth. It's interesting that the word against here is not the word you would anticipate for the word against. It's a good translation. But it's not the usual word. The usual word is anti. Opposed to. Lie not, opposed to the truth. The word here is kata. To press down on. You know when you've got Jell-O like we have for lunch, and you press down on it, what happens to it? It squishes over the place. It's lying against the truth, not by being opposed to the truth, but by stretching it. It's the lie of the stretch of the truth. And that's really the concept here. That kind of debate, which comes either out of a bitter response to an experience or out of trying to prove myself right, will result in a lie because it will result in stretching the truth to meet my own needs. This is the kind of lie that it is producing. That wisdom does not descend from above. That kind of wisdom has three characteristics. It is earthly, sensual, devilish. Now let's look at those three characteristics of this wisdom. The word earthly means purely that. Earthly. Of the earth, from the earth. It is that which is opposed to from the spirit. It is that which relates to human wisdom. But that is even stronger implied in the next word, sensual. Now this is not sensual from the standpoint of a sensuous person. Seductive. Sexy. That's not the thought of sensual. But pertaining to the senses. Pertaining to the five senses. That which is perceived by the senses. There's a contrast here between the word sensual here and the words from above. Wisdom from above is spiritual. It's pneuma. It has to do with the mind. The spirit of the mind. The word sensual is suki. Of the matter of the mind. Of the thoughts of the mind. In other words, the wisdom is from below that he's describing is your own wisdom. That which you would like to think is right. That which you have made up. And that which is that comes because we are motivated either by reaction, bitter zeal, or by vainglory, strife. Either of these two will produce this sensual. And because it is that, it's diabolical. It's devilish. It's misleading. It will not only throw our listener off, it will lead us astray that as well. For where this kind of zeal, envying, again that same word, zealous, for where this kind of zeal and where this kind of proving self-right, strife, is there is confusion and every evil work. The word confusion is another interesting word. A lot of interesting word plays in this passage. The word here is made up of three Greek words put together. The word's to stand, and then the word kata, which means firmly stand, and then the letter A, the negative. This causes one to not have a firm standing. That's the word confusion. Where one is uncertain, unstable, where there is this kind of wisdom, because it does not have a source that is inviolable, because its source is not correct, the wisdom does not give true stability. It's what you think. It's out of the opinion pocket instead of out of the fact pocket, because you don't have the facts. You only have a partial comprehension. This kind of reasoning, based upon reaction or based upon proving self-right, will always produce a lack of stability and understanding, uncertain understanding, and it produces evil works, false conclusions that lead to false works. That is the setting for our text. That's the setting for the theme. He's telling us what not to have. Having told us what not to have, and why we get that, because we react to others, he tells us what to have in its place. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, and so on. So frequently, I have heard over the years that I've heard discussion in this text translated as though it were saying, the wisdom that is from above is first accurate. Or, the wisdom that is from above is first true. Those may be both true statements. But that's not what James is saying. If James wanted to say, the wisdom that is from above is first accurate, he probably would have said, the wisdom that is from above is first accurate. That would have been the accurate way to say it. But he didn't. He did not use the word for accuracy or truth. He used the word for pure. Let me give you another place where that word is used. That means pure. It's the word for pure. But what is purity? Purity is not a synonym for truth or accuracy. Purity may involve truth or accuracy, but it is not a synonym. It's a different concept. 1 Peter, the third chapter, the second, first and second verses, uses the same word, and it translates the word chaste. Likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may, without the word, be won by the conversation or behavior of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear, your pure conversation. Now, you would hardly put the word accurate there. You'd hardly put the word truth. What you're really putting there is the word your holy conversation. And that really is the best definition of the word pure here. The wisdom that is from above is first holy. The word comes from the usual word translated holy, hagios. It's the basic thought of that which is contrasted with natural, not that which is contrasted with error. It is the opposite of natural. The wisdom that is from above is first spiritual. It deals with holy things. It obviously deals with them as correctly as you're able. But that's not the point of emphasis. The point of emphasis is holiness. That it is a wisdom productive of spiritual things. I'm sure we're all familiar with the reasoning of Paul in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter. Now, rather lengthy ending to the second chapter. We'll just pick up verse 11. For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knoweth no man but the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God. Let me retranslate this verse using James terminology. For what natural man knoweth the things of a natural man, except he has the spirit of a natural man within him? Even so, the things of the Spirit doesn't anybody know but the Spirit of God. The contrast is, natural men can know natural things. They can have knowledge, but they can't have that wisdom that comes from above. The wisdom that comes from above must first be from above. It must first be holy. It must first deal with holy topics in a holy manner. It is an adverb describing how to believe, not an adjective describing what the belief is. So the wisdom from above is, first of all, a holy, related to holy subjects. Then, being related to that, it is peaceable. And just as the word pure here is set in opposition to natural before, so peaceable is set in opposition to strife before. Here's your contrast. This wisdom was bitter from natural experience, and it was strifeful. This wisdom is pure during a spiritual experience, and it is peaceable. It is not full of strife. It is the opposite. It is willing to produce peace. Our Thursday night study this week in Chicago, we were dealing with the subject of how one becomes a son of God and what that term means. And it was interesting in the discussion that we got back to the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. And there are a lot of Beatitudes, a lot of things that a Christian should be. But only one of the Beatitudes promised as a reward for being what the Beatitudes said, sonship with God. Matthew 5:9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they are called the sons of God. He does not choose the term sons of God to describe the reward for the meek. It may be so. He does not choose it for the merciful or the pure in heart. It may be so. He chooses it to be the reward for the peacemakers. Here, the wisdom is from above. Being pure, being holy, is peaceable. It's not a contrast of two opposites. That now that I am accurate, now I can afford to be peaceable. They're not opposites. These are complementary things. These are things that go together. Holiness is peaceableness. The two are part of a same unit. Which brings up the topic. What is peace? Shalom. How well we know the word shalom, the Hebrew word for peace. But what does the word shalom mean? Peace? That's correct. But that's only part of the story. In Deuteronomy one case, Moses instructs the people that when they build an altar to the Lord, to build that altar out of whole stones, and thereupon to offer their peace offerings. And the word shalom is not the word for peace offerings there, but the word for whole. To use shalom stones as the basis for shalem offerings, peace offerings. Shalom basically means oneness. Husband and wife are having a spat. There's an argument develops, and they want peace. What do they want? To regain their oneness. Countries are at war. And they seek peace. They seek to sit down and discuss oneness. We feel a lack of peace. We feel a need for what Christ said we should have, the peace of God that passes all understanding. What do we want? We want oneness. We want holiness. We want an instruction to do it God's way. Peace is comprehending God's way. Peace is doing it God's way. The wisdom that is from above first is holy. Being holy, it is peace productive. It is peaceable. But in doing this, it is gentle. I like the way that Vine's Expository Dictionary defines this word gentle. Sweetly reasonable. Isn't that a nice phrase? The wisdom that is from above is sweetly reasonable. It makes me think of that text we all know so well from Isaiah, the first chapter. Come, let us reason together. Although your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. That true wisdom is not dictatorial. True wisdom is not dogmatic. True wisdom is reasonable because true wisdom is meek. How often have we heard the point raised in a discussion? We can't both be right. The implication is one is right and one is wrong. There's only one truth. And that's obviously true. There is only one truth. What is not obviously true is that you have it or that I have it. That is a point yet to be proven. Truth is there as an absolute, but it is a goal, not a present achievement, not a present attainment. It is that which is to be striven for. On one occasion in the question book, the question was asked of Brother Russell, why do you call yourselves truth people? And his answer was, not because we have the truth, but because the truth is the most important thing for us, and that's what we're striving for. It is the objective. And in reaching that, where there's disagreement, there must be sweet reasonableness. That is a product of that meekness that says, I too need to know what is truth. It is that mutual search. Then it is easy to be entreated. It's quick to say, maybe I don't understand the whole picture. What's your side of the matter? The story is told of the old-time judge from out west who had a horse thief brought before him. And as the prosecuting attorney made his case, it was so convincing, the judge said, I've heard enough, hang the man. And I said, Judge, don't I even get a chance to tell my story? Okay, tell it and get over with. And he told his story, and the judge scratched his head and he said, doesn't that beat all? Now he's innocent. That sometimes when we hear the full side, we have to say, oh, I didn't think of that. There's an easy to be entreated. There's the easiness for questioning in the wisdom that's from above. Because the wisdom that's from above is born out of meekness. It's born out of the thought, I need to learn and not only to teach. Another old saying I'm sure you're familiar with is when you talk, you repeat what you already know. When you listen, there's a possibility you might learn something. That this reasonableness opens the mind to another thought. In Luke, the 11th chapter, there is a strong condemnation of the scribes and the Pharisees. And he says, woe unto you, lawyers! You have taken away the key of knowledge. You enter not in yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hindered. What is the key of knowledge? The key of knowledge is an open ear. That's what they weren't giving. They came with that wisdom that was from below to the Lord, a wisdom that was reacting to Him. That wisdom that was there to prove that they were right. And as a result, they did not have that wisdom that was born out of meekness. Because meekness, the open ear, is the key of knowledge. And when we take that away, we do it in such a way that we try not only to deprive ourselves, but to convince all others. Don't listen to that person. He's dangerous. Then we have not the wisdom that's from above. It is full of mercy and good fruits. It recognizes that the opponent to that wisdom may have an erring viewpoint, but it's merciful toward that viewpoint, realizing that based upon the information you have at hand, the conclusion you made is logical. Therefore, I'm very merciful to that. I remember a brother once, somebody was mentioning to him, do you know that they think this and this about you? And he said, if I had heard what they had heard, I'd have thought the same thing. That they were acting upon the knowledge that they had, and therefore they reached that conclusion. But there is a mercifulness to this wisdom that is from above, and therefore is full of the good fruit. And I think the good fruit here is particularly the good fruit of forgiveness, the good fruit of being able to forgive the one for having the wrongness. It is without partiality. I sort of like to, in my own mind, translate that it has no names attached. So often we look at a situation or a principle or even a doctrine and we attach names to it. So-and-so teaches that, therefore it must be true. Or so-and-so is very prominent, therefore this can't be. Or so-and-so is a nobody, and maybe they may be subject to this. And because you put the name there, it off-balances the judgment. That's why justice is always portrayed as a blindfolded person. It is looking at the scales with not identifying people. Therefore, there's an equality to the judgment. It is not based upon the who, but the what of the judgment. There can be no partiality, and it's without hypocrisy. It realizes that I, in turn, am liable to the same judgments that I render. Who art thou, O man, that judgest another? For the things thou judgest, thou art thyself guilty. The words of St. Paul. And the fruit of this righteousness, the exercise of this wisdom that's from above, is sown, and he goes right back to the then peaceable. It's sown in peace. But only sown in peace to those who are willing to make peace. Without the ability and desire to use this wisdom to achieve harmony and peace, it will not make peace. Now I want to go to two Old Testament texts, and in doing this, to sort of round out our subject. In Proverbs, the 9th chapter, the first verse, we have a nice little statement about wisdom. Wisdom has builded her house, she hath hewn out her 7 pillars. Our text in James 3. The wisdom that is from above is first, pure. Second, peaceable. Third, gentle. Fourth, easy to be entreated. Fifth, full of mercy and good fruits. Sixth, without partiality. And seventh, without hypocrisy. James gives us 7 pillars to determine how true wisdom operates. But I think we're all alike that we can best see how principles operate by seeing those principles in operation in a laboratory situation where they're actually used. And to many of you, I have to apologize because I use this text so often, but I can't help but use it again because it illustrates so perfectly these 7 principles. Job, the 33rd chapter, where the young man Elihu begins his address to Job. Before he corrects Job, he lays down 7 guidelines, the same number. And this time, as we notice these 7 guidelines, we want to notice these in connection with James 3. We want to do a comparative study of Job 33:3-12, with James 3:17-18. Now, we're not going to find them in the same order. We're going to find the same 7 principles. I always like to think of this passage of Job, and my mind's got a subheading: the 7 rules of proper criticism. The 7 rules of a debate or discussion when there is a difference of opinion. Verses 3 and 4. My word shall be the uprightness of my heart. My lips shall utter knowledge clearly. The Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life. The first thing that Elihu does is, I want to assure you, Job, that I'm speaking out of uprightness. I'm here, I'm speaking, as I see the matter for the Lord as principles of truth. The Lord has given knowledge, and I'm trying to be upright in my judgment. In other words, Elihu's wisdom was first pure. He starts with that holy principle of an uprightness, not necessarily a correctness. He's not demanding that his be infallible words. But he said, whenever I'm speaking uprightly. My motives are clear. My motives are pure. The motivational factor is right. Verse 5, if thou canst set thy words in order before me, stand up. He invites a rebuttal. He does not take the position of an adversary relationship. He takes the position of a friendly relationship. Let's discuss the matter. Peaceableness. That peaceableness comes in next. My object here is to speak to you peaceably. The first half of verse 6. Behold, I am according to thy wish in God's stead. He is speaking, he says, I'm here because you have, either verbally or by body language, invited me to take part. Because I perceive that you want correction, I'll be involved. Anything else would be busybody, meddling. But because I perceive it's by your wish I'm in God's stead, I'm willing to be here. He's exhibiting that attribute of wisdom of easy to be entreated. I don't wait for your words. You've left enough open that I can see you're entreating for an answer. This is my opinion. The second half of verse 6. I also am formed out of the clay. I got the same problems, the same weaknesses you have. Maybe a little different area, but we're not one above the other. There's an equality here. Elihu was demonstrating that the wisdom that's from above is gentle. There's a gentility to that recognition that I'm not talking down to you. Verse 7, my terror shall not make thee afraid, neither shall my hand be heavy upon thee. I want to assure you, Job, that I'm here to lift you up, not to squeeze your face in the dirt, not to make you eat dust. I am here to try to be very helpful to you, not oppressive, because the wisdom that's from above is merciful and is full of good fruits. And that's an exhibit of the mercifulness, that I'm not here to condemn. I'm not here to criticize. I'm here to assist. I'm here to help. Verse 8, surely thou hast spoken in mine hearing, and I've heard the voice of thy words. There was no hearsay evidence permitted in the court administered by Elihu. Say, I'll only comment on what I've heard. I will not comment on what your other three comforters have said, even what I heard from your wife the other day. I'll only comment on the words that you have spoken, because I want the wisdom that I'm using to be without partiality, to be unbiased by what another person thinks, but only on first-hand evidence that has come to me. Then he quotes Job's words, I am clean without transgression. Yes, Job did say that. I am innocent. There's no iniquity in me. Job said that. Behold, God finds occasion against me and counts me for his enemy. Job said that. God puts my feet in the stocks and he marks all my paths. Job said that. Well, that's too bad that Job said it. It's understandable he said it. He didn't start out saying that. He started out saying, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. But as he got attacked by his critics, he got more and more defensive, and he said those things. So he quotes those words back, and he says, Job, in this you're not just. Notice the specificity. He specifically mentions the items that were wrong. He doesn't say, therefore, Job, you're a bad man. This, Job, was wrong. He separates the sin from the sinner. And by doing that, he avoids the problem of hypocrisy. He's without hypocrisy. He is identifying exactly what's there. He's not putting himself in a point of comparison. He's only saying, let's look at a principle, what is right and what is wrong, and not who's done it. So in Elihu's approach, he demonstrates the truthfulness of the text that the committee has chosen for this convention. Let's go back again to James, the third chapter. Giving a paraphrase reading now to summarize the lessons of this section. Who is wise? Who has true understanding among you? Let that person demonstrate it by behavior that shows that his works are manifested out of a wisdom that is teachable, progressive, and learnable. But if, on the other hand, you have a strong feeling that is motivated by a reaction to a bad experience, or if you have a desire to prove yourself right, then don't have any boasting in that. That forces you into a lie, distorting the truth. That kind of wisdom does not come from above. That kind of wisdom deals with things of the earth. That kind of wisdom is based upon what your senses know and faith has no part in. That kind of wisdom, therefore, is diabolical. For where that kind of wisdom, either the reaction or the personal glory is there, there will be no strong standing, and that will produce evil works. But the wisdom I want you to have in contrast, who then is wise, is the wisdom that is first of all holy in its manner of conduct. And then being holy, it seeks to produce peace because it is gentle, because it is willing to listen to the other side, because it is full of mercy and quick to forgive, because it does not pay attention to the person but the action, and because it strives not to be hypocritical, realizing it itself can be judged. The fruit of that kind of righteous wisdom is the product of peace, but only if we have the desire to make peace.